Hey gang, this week's episode is proudly brought to you by Newspapers.com, the ultimate playground for uncovering the Grand Slam moments of baseball's past. If you're a fan of the game, you're about to step into a time capsule of home runs and heroes. Newspapers.com lets you relive the glory days with nearly a billion pages of historical newspapers, capturing the crack of the bat, the roar of the crowd, and the unforgettable stories that define baseball history. Explore your favorite teams and players in papers nationwide dating back to baseball's beginnings in the 1840s. For our baseball-loving listeners, Newspapers.com has really knocked it out of the park with a special offer. Use the code GSA20 for an exclusive 20% discount on your subscription. That's promo code GSA20 on Newspapers.com. It's your front row seat to the stories that made baseball the timeless sport we love. And now, here's our show.
It's been almost 20 years since the Vancouver Grizzlies relocated to Memphis, Tennessee. But now, a part of the old team is coming back, and some basketball fans are not happy about it. In the days before DVDs and smart TVs lived the Vancouver Grizzlies. Debuting in 1995, the basketball team called Vancouver home until 2001, when ownership unexpectedly moved it to Memphis. It caught the city by surprise.
The fans have been really supportive of the team, and the owners are falsely accusing them of not being supportive of the team. So
keep the Grizzlies in Vancouver.
Come on, save our Grizzlies.
Fans who had invested emotionally had the team taken from them.
This upcoming season will be the team's 25th year in the NBA. The now Memphis Grizzlies posting this video online on Thursday, saying it'll celebrate the milestone on select game days by wearing the iconic teal Vancouver Grizzlies jerseys. The retro uniform will also be available for purchase.
And now it kind of feels like you're pouring salt in the wound by bringing back Vancouver's old jerseys and trying to make money off of it.
Not even in Canada, but a completely different place having that. Yeah, I would say that's kind of salt on the wound.
The jersey announcement being met with uproar online as well. Fans making it clear it's still too soon. No. Thanks for reopening the wound. So many fond memories from when you stole our team. As a Vancouverite, I hate this. I hate this so much.
People in Memphis don't care. Do they even know where Vancouver is?
But not everyone is so bitter. Some seeing it as a tribute to a team that won over a city while hardly winning on the court.
I would love anything that just sort of refers back to the Vancouver team, even if it doesn't exist anymore.
For those who want a team back in Vancouver, the blowback from the jersey announcement can only help.
The fact that the reaction is there tells you the passion for basketball does exist in this market.
And maybe the NBA will see that passion and give this city another shot. In Vancouver, Travis Prasad, City News.
Welcome to Good Seats Still Available, a curious little podcast devoted to exploring what used to be in professional sports. Here's your host, Tim Hanlon.
Well, greetings and salutations, everyone. It is your pal, Tim Hanlon, once again dominating your podcast feed. It is Good Seats Still Available, the curious little podcast that is devoted to what used to be in professional sports. Thanks for coming on by, and thanks for those who listened last week and indulging me with the drop of an old episode from our archives, one of our earliest episodes from 2017, back when we were kind of just starting this show. That was our investigation into the story of the 1943 NFL Steagles, that odd shaped combination of the Philadelphia Eagles and the Pittsburgh Steelers back in the midst of World War II back here in the States, as many of the players were going off to war. The NFL was fighting for its survival, and our pal Matt Algio, who I don't think lives in Mozambique anymore, but back then was joining us live and exclusive from the capital thereof. This week, we are setting our sights back to basketball, and it's kind of a mea culpa episode, frankly, because I have just dropped the ball on this one for a number of months, and to nobody's fault except my own. And our return guest this week, Lukasz Minyowski, I always have a tough time saying that, Lukasz Minyowski, who is a repeat guest, by the way. You'd think I'd be able to pronounce the name properly. Great guy, professor in Poland. American sports and history and that kind of stuff is his area of focus. Lukasz was with us back in January of 23, about a year plus ago, when we were talking about our episode number 289 about the New Jersey Nets, the gutty, gritty New Jersey Nets, the version of the current franchise when they were in New Jersey and a very compelling conversation. Lukasz's book at the time, still available, called Turnpike Team, The History of the New Jersey Nets, out now, available. And we had a great chat. And we had a subsequent chat about his new book. Well, I don't know how new it is anymore. It came out in, turns out it came out in, oh my goodness, I think it was the tail end of 23, right? I think it was October of 23. And we had this conversation numerous months ago. I lost the file. That didn't help. I misjudged when the book was going to be released. I was looking at some wrong information. And all of that is my fault. But now, through patience on Lukasz's part and through the good graces of the calendar, I am finally able to bring this conversation to you about the story that you heard in the clip that sets up the tone here. It is about the Vancouver Grizzlies and their move to Memphis. So essentially, this is a story about the more about the Memphis reception, if you will, of this Vancouver Grizzlies franchise. You may remember that we had a wonderful a conversation back a number of months ago with Kat Jamie, our episode number 312, where we were talking about the Vancouver Grizzlies. That's very much a story of fandom and growing up, watching the games and falling in love with the team at the time. This part of the story, though, is very much sort of the acrid and unfortunate, frankly, move of this franchise from Vancouver, where it had only been there for a handful of years and was trumpeted along with the Toronto Raptors back when they were expanding in the the NBA to get into Canada finally. And while Toronto still soldiers on, the Grizzlies didn't take much time. It was about 9 or 10 seasons before they absconded to the city of Memphis, where they still reside after it's almost 23, 24 seasons now. Not a great season this season. This one just finished. The Grizzlies were division champs for the last two seasons, but this season fell dramatically through a whole bunch of different reasons to not even make the playoffs this year. So the conversation with Lukasz Myniowski this week is about the move and the settlement, shall we say, of this Grizzlies franchise from their original roots in Vancouver to where they now reside in Memphis. And the book that is now available, it has been available since October of last year. And again, this is all my fault. It is called The Grizzlies Migrate to Memphis, From Vancouver Failure to Southern Success, by our guest this week, Lukasz. Boy, oh boy, Myniowski. I just call it, say, Lukasz. It's probably the most the easiest way to say it in a more anglicized fashion, but I do my best. He, again, is an assistant professor at Szczecin University in Poland. There you go. He not only the author of the previous New Jersey Nets book, but this one, which is published by the University of Tennessee Press. And again, it is available wherever you can find good books, including our website at goodseatsstillavailable.com. Just search up this episode number 345 with Lukasz, and you will find a convenient link or two to the book, the hardcover version, the Kindle version, etc. We appreciate you doing so. We appreciate you, of course, listening and supporting the team. Let me just give you a quick second on this clip. So the clip there, that was from August of 2019, and that was obviously a few years back, and that was when I wouldn't call it a celebration, it was probably more the commemoration of the former version of the team, the Vancouver Grizzlies. And that was a Travis Prasad of City News in Vancouver. And you can hear there's still some bitter aftertaste, shall we say, in Vancouver, and frankly, some hope that Vancouver can once again ascend the professional basketball ranks and perhaps once again host a team. It's a great city, Vancouver, as people know. Vancouver Whitecaps, fun to watch. The BC Lions and the CFL, and certainly the Canucks and the NHL. And I believe they even have a Canadian professional soccer team as well up there, too, I guess what you would call it, Division II. So a great sports town, and lots of it's just a beautiful city through and through. So why not And I think the NBA will probably be expanding anyway. So, you know, maybe Vancouver might get a better look than Las Vegas. I don't know. We'll see. But let us speculate in the midst of this conversation. Let's talk about how the Grizzlies migrated from Vancouver to Memphis. Here's our conversation with Lukasz that we had, geez, numbers of months back. I want to say it was like November of last year. My apologies, but it is my pleasure to present it to you now. So please, as always, enjoy. Remind our audience, for those who didn't have the pleasure of listening to our episode about the New Jersey Nets, where we find you and who you and what you are.
Okay, so I live in Poland. I was born here as well. I currently stay in like a small village near Warsaw, and I'm an academic. Well, I'm an assistant professor at the University of Szczecin. Good luck pronouncing that. Well, I teach American literature. I hold a PhD in American literature and American culture as well. And I have written several books now about American sports. Some are academic, some are not. Well, they've all been published by academic presses. So, well, as you said, the most recent up until this one was about the New Jersey Nets. And this current book is about the Vancouver/Memphis Grizzlies and the process of relocation primarily.
So what is it about American sports, and I'm guessing basketball in particular, that excites you or motivates you enough to follow, to document, to go deeper, and specifically what kinds of teams and stuff kind of fit your sort of criteria of interest?
Yeah, okay. That's a solid question, because it's like you do some things, but you rarely think about them once you're doing them or why are you doing them. So maybe for me, it's American sports. I've been always like captivated by American sports. Well, especially basketball and American football. Now I'm just in and out when it comes to fandom and wrestling, but it's not sports actually, but I'm a big fan of American wrestling, of professional wrestling as well. And to be honest, I was just growing up in a time when this stuff was becoming popular. It was like the early 90s, and you know, the whole our country was opening up to Western influences, and there was just so much of these Western influences, whether I understood their impact or not, or the implications behind them or not, mostly not because I was just a kid, but all the economic and social processes that were happening that were being carried to Poland via broadcasts of various sporting events and sporting entertainment, if you want to include wrestling in the broader scope of things. So that's basically what I grew up with and what I like to assume I have a like intrinsic understanding or instinct, or it's like my instinct to follow American sports and just try to understand them. Maybe, yeah, I guess that's the best answer I can give.
Yeah, well, no, sure. But how much of that is or has been informed by actual on the ground recognizance here in the United States, or has this all been through the lens of television, media, and from afar?
Okay. Actually, I've been to the States just twice, unfortunately. I would like to be there more. I only saw one NBA game live, and it was an interesting game because it was like Phoenix Suns against Oklahoma City Thunder. So super random, just an event. So basically, it was all done from the comfort of my beautiful home country. And just as I'm saying it, just as I'm answering your question now, I see that I forgot to answer the second part of your question about the teams that meet my criteria. So if I may, is that fine if I can answer?
Sure. Unraveling the onion. Yes, please.
Okay. It's a nice comparison because actually in Poland, onion is like one of our like to make fun of things that are typically Polish that we compare them to onions. And so like onion people, maybe it's like in Polish, it's cebulaki. So people who are quintessentially Polish in a negative way, we compare them to onions. So your usage of the word onion, was it a guess or was it
Who knows? That's just, you know.
Yeah, okay. Because I wanted to like congratulate you on your research if that was like an
I'll take it, you know.
Okay, cool. So the teams, well, I don't want to say that I'm like a fan of failure, but there's something about underdogs that just excites me. Like, for example, when I think about the New York Knicks, the first thing that comes to my mind is not like the 1970s, because obviously I wasn't alive back then, or the 1990s. And well, they didn't win the championship, but they made the finals twice. I think about like the period afterwards, but like Allen Houston, Eddie Curry, and all this stuff. Or when I think about Golden State Warriors, the Golden State Warriors that I liked the most were actually those in like the 1995-96 season. And just the early Don Nelson Golden State Warriors, so earlier as well and later. So generally, there's this thing about failure or just being on the cusp of greatness, maybe. This is also something that I find very interesting because, I mean, dynasties are fun, but what is there to actually explore when it comes to somebody or like a team that is successful, right? I mean, failure is, I think, more captivating, even though it is much easier to fail, clearly. I don't want to sound like very negative or just make generalizations, but I mean, most of our lives don't pan out the way that we hope or that they should, right? I mean, you do all the things correctly. Let's say you're like a basketball team and you do everything the right way. You share the ball, you practice, you abstain from like the temptations that being a celebrity creates you still fail because there can only be one champion. So that's like what I find so captivating in sports, that you have in the NBA, you have like, I know, 32, I'm bad at math, to be honest, teams, and only one will win. So the rest will eventually end in a failure, quote unquote failure, because clearly those people are not failures, and what they achieve can rarely be considered failure. When you think about draft busts as well, it's not failure. I mean, people make the NBA. That's like such a great achievement. There are no accidental people in the NBA, I assume. I mean, as you think about like armchair coaches, right? They always like to assume that they know better, but clearly there are no accidental people in like these high positions. So even though I'm talking about failure, clearly I'm not meaning failure in like the most devastating or just sad sense, but more failure on the highest level is not really failure. I don't know if that makes sense.
Yeah, no, that actually does. I probably go a little, maybe one step further and broaden it, because this is sort of the whole focus of this stupid little show that I've been doing for, I don't know, almost 8 years now, for God's sakes, who knows why. But the fascination for me is, you know, these are teams in particular, or leagues or whatever, that somehow were legit, who were playing at the top level, who were around, and for whatever reasons are now essentially forgotten or discarded, mm-hmm. or not part of, you know, the goings on currently, or maybe they are, but in a distant past were in a previous form or incarnation. And to me, that's kind of like, that becomes more interesting than, you know, a team that's been around for 50 years and it's won 10 championships and that kind of stuff. Like the one game or a couple of seasons where they played this particular team and that isn't around anymore. What was that? Mm-hmm. why was that? How did that come to be? And frankly, why is it no longer part of the mix? Because to mm-hmm. me, that's always like a head scratcher. And it's a curiosity to me that I guess is, to me, worthy of exploration, especially if it has been forgotten. You wonder what used to be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's basically, I mean, as sports fans, we always like to ask the question, what if, right? So, I mean, I love the whole idea behind your show, because it's the same idea that I have when it comes to, I don't want to use like big words like writing or just writing books, because I mean, but just stuff that I'm interested in and I'm trying to explore, because clearly there is always more to explore that we as people who are doing it from a distance are allowed to do. There's always like a part of the story that hasn't yet been told when it comes to these quote-unquote like failures or teams or leagues that no longer exist. Yeah, so I find that interesting as well.
Yeah, so all right. So let's then sort of put our energies towards why this particular little wrinkle in the fabric of the NBA. We've talked to a few people directly and indirectly about this Vancouver mm-hmm. Grizzlies thing. Cat Jamie in particular, who has this actually a bunch of documentaries, one of which is still not sort of fully released yet. And, you know, she was literally a local at the time, growing up as a kid and then becoming a professional filmmaker, documentarian. And clearly the story there for her, a lot of it was rooted in her childhood and those kinds of memories and stuff. But how and why did you come to this story? Was it an understanding of the current franchise in Memphis, or a fascination with the 6 year blip that was the incarnation of the team prior, or were you just spinning the globe and you just happened to point on Vancouver, mm-hmm. British Columbia? What was it?
Yeah, so I want to say that I listened to your interview with Kat as well with great interest, and her story was very personal, right? You can hear that she was there and her energy is almost like infectious, because you've probably seen the movie as well, like the first,
yeah,
about big countries was great, right? And I mean, I was actually in conversation with her that she would hopefully provide a blurb, but she was involved in like editing and just stuff with the movie that she wasn't able to read the manuscript, and obviously I didn't want to like a blurb from somebody who hasn't read the book, and she did not want to provide one if she wasn't able to read it, so it just I talked about a blurb from her. But we exchanged emails quite a bit, and we came to the same conclusions when it comes to the failure of the team in Vancouver, but we will get to that later, I guess, right? So why this particular city? Well, when you think about like expansion of the NBA in the 1990s, like David Stern had this big plan, right? That the NBA was going to become global. And like the first step to globalization of, well, not globalization, a global domination of the NBA, it was kind of obvious that he wanted to pick, well, you pick Canada, right? Because of the NAFTA pact, and there are just like some economic, it was just economically convenient to enter this market. He also tried to enter, like, play some games in Mexico City, but eventually no team appeared in Mexico as of now, right? So the Toronto Raptors were always, like, well, not always, but they were more or less successful. Like, the management was competent and they were able to draft good guys. I mean, they picked Vince Carter, right, which was a great pick. And he made that franchise popular. And as opposed to Vancouver, which never seemed to draft the proper players. And I was really interested in, when you think about teams who actually are historically bad, you think about, I don't know, I don't want to offend anybody here, but you think about, like, Los Angeles Clippers, for example, who have been bad for decades. And as Charles Barkley even once said, that he's been slim, he's been fat, he's been rich, he's been poor, and the Clippers have always sucked. And it struck me as interesting that you have a team that is always bad, yet it stays in Los Angeles, right? And you have a team that's trying. I mean, you can't fault the management and the people in Vancouver in general for what happened, because they tried, they thought that they were doing the right thing, and yet basketball in Vancouver failed. And I was really interested in why did that happen? Why Toronto was like this place where everything seemed to work, and it still works till this day. I mean, they have an NBA championship. I mean, who would have expected that, and yet Vancouver failed, and it failed so badly. It was just such a disappointing team, and year after year, when you think about, like, their draft decisions, and then was it bad luck? Were the decisions just made by the wrong people? Was there, like, something else, something in the air? I don't know. And I just wanted to explore that. And I just wanted to see what actually happened and understand what actually happened when it came to the Grizzlies, as opposed to other teams who either relocated or failed. And there's, like, the other side of the coin. So when we're talking about Vancouver, we need to also talk about Memphis and why the Grizzlies were such a success in Memphis, which was also what I was interested in, and how the same team just changes locations, right? In, like, three seasons, I think they are in the playoffs, and they win 50 games, whereas in Vancouver, their best record was, I think, 23. If I remember correctly, it was like 23 wins. And then after just 2-3 years, they have 50 wins and they appear in the playoffs. And they have a really interesting roster. And I was interested in what changed. How big is the impact of the city on the success of the franchise, and whether that coincides with how the franchise is actually able to influence the city. And I just wanted to see how this works. And it's also interesting, I'm sorry, I'm just talking so much, but I was also interested in, because when you think of the expansion of American leagues, when you think about the NHL, for example, I found it interesting because I was reading this book on the Whalers, and there was, like, a whole chapter about the southward expansion of the NHL. Whereas for the NBA, it was the northward expansion. And basically, the goals were the same. So in the NHL, it was to make the South, when we think about, like, the Atlanta Flames, even a team that is no longer with this, right? The goal was to make the South relevant, whereas when it came to Vancouver, the goal was to make the dream city relevant and present in like the global, basically, because NBA was global at the time. It was a global phenomenon. Make the North or Canada, I don't want to say relevant, but because it was relevant, right? But
we certainly went through some of the detail with Kat about sort of the Vancouver situation, and I think we kind of netted out there were a bunch of different situations that were kind of happening around sort of the same time. The Toronto and Vancouver expansion thing, right, happened at the same time. Mm-hmm. Both started in the 95-96 season, and neither of them were particularly good those seasons, although Toronto in their sixth season barely got a playoff round, and they were quickly swept away from the Knicks in the first round. But you know, it was certainly some kind of progress. But Vancouver, you know, was pretty woeful, and arguably was maybe more woeful than the Raptors were. But I guess the question in there is two teams in Canada as expansion.
People in Toronto were already interested in that, as opposed to people in Vancouver. I didn't want to say like all the people, but the people who were into like the whole expansion thing. What I found was that Vancouver was basically trying. Vancouver saw what Toronto was doing, and they decided to jump on the opportunity and just, well, I don't want to blame anyone for joining this whole process, but when you think about people who wanted to prove everybody wrong, we need to talk about Arthur Griffiths, right? Who was the son of a local sports magnate, the owner of the Vancouver Canucks, and he wanted to prove his parents wrong. So we have like this sort of family drama involved here. You have this prodigal son who at age 24 or 26 joins his father's company, and like he gets a big position clearly because he's the apparent heir. And he wants to make a statement, and he sees NBA basketball, and he finds it exciting. He thinks that it will make his team, well, if his not yet created team, popular in the city. Like, people will respond to that. I mean, Vancouver is the city of the future, right? It's called Dream City. People are impressed with Vancouver, the way it's developing. And he hopes that NBA basketball will help to fill seats in the arena. And so the motivations are quite different, in my opinion. That's just my personal opinion from the stuff that I was able to read and talk to some people, is that Toronto always wanted to have an NBA, always, quote unquote, but way earlier wanted to have an NBA franchise whenever the possibility for expansion appeared, as opposed to Vancouver, who was just like a tag along, if I may use that. And the NBA also didn't do Vancouver any favors, because originally the NBA was skeptical as well, just from when I think about like statements of the expansion committee. So they were reluctant. They basically, Toronto was like a shoo-in is the phrase, right? When something is certain, the phrase is shoo-in, I guess, right? Am I understanding
that
correctly?
Yeah, sure.
Ah, okay. So, yeah, thanks. So, so Toronto was a shoo-in, as opposed to Vancouver, who was just like a tag-along. And basically, up until the meeting, the official meeting, nobody knew whether Vancouver would get a chance as well. So in a sense, they were just like kind of, I don't know if they were surprised that they actually got the franchise, because I guess that some people were certain that they would, because after all, somebody paid the expansion fee, right?
Yeah, so what I think I'm hearing you say is that Toronto was pretty much the sort of the main focus of this, and Vancouver more conveniently seemed to have other ducks in a row to also make that a two-team sort of proposition versus an elegant one-team expansion. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it was also convenient because Arthur Griffiths has just built a new arena, the GM place. So he thought that, I mean, what I'm going to do with the other days in the year? What can I do to fill the seats? And he was like, I know, let's take on an NBA franchise as well. Let's make the GM place the home of an NBA team. Why not?
Well, so Griffiths had inherited this team, and that's from his family, and he sort of went on to obviously build the GM place, and I think he was also part of the Vancouver Olympic committee, and a bunch of other things. But I guess the real wrinkle in this, and we haven't really kind of explored this, but I'm curious to hear your understanding of this, is he actually sold the majority ownership of the team literally 6 months before the team began to play. So yes. What was that all about? Because that's where John McCaw, the guy behind, he was a big wireless mobile phone guy, technology guy. 6 months before a new franchise is supposed to expand in the NBA, selling the majority ownership. That sounds a little strange to me.
Yeah. I mean, basically, it's actually hard to understand from my opinion as well, because I mean he was the one who paid the non-refundable like $100,000 right fee, and he did not have nothing. He had just an arena, maybe a group of like close associates, and he sells the franchise, right? So I don't really know why would he do that, to be honest. So
it does signal, and if I'm in the emphasis at the time,
it sounds very problematic, right?
Yeah, it signals a bit of uncertainty or something. And my understanding is that Griffiths ultimately had to sell both the Canucks and the Grizzlies due to the I guess he was overextended. I think the GM place was kind of running long in terms of cost overruns and that kind of stuff. And who knows? But I mean, I guess that unless we can somehow get Mr. Griffiths on the show someday to kind of talk about it. But I guess it's sort of an inauspicious beginning to a team that, was, on the docket for the NBA play and stuff. I guess the other sort of real question is, what about the support for the team? I mean, it was pretty clear, I guess, in the beginning, right? It's always, hey, we're an NBA franchise, and this is puts Vancouver again on the map now beyond just an NHL team and all that kind of stuff. The initial fervor, right, and the fandom and stuff. And Kat was certainly very long and memorable about the fans in the stands and stuff, but it doesn't take long for the product to reveal itself as being, shall we say, less than. Why do you think it soured so relatively quickly? Because even before, sooner than six seasons, there was already rumors in the air that this team was not for long.
Yeah. I mean, there were a couple of reasons, clearly. I mean, if I may just return to the Canucks for a moment. So Canucks are notorious for like breaking the hearts of their fans, right? But the thing about Canucks is that they actually make the playoffs, right? They actually get somewhere in the playoffs from time to time. Well, not recently, if I think, when I think about like the Sandin Twins, is probably the best period that the Canucks had in like recent history. So generally it's hard to get invested in a franchise that basically in January or early February, by the All-Star break, they are already out of playoff contention and there's nothing to to look forward to. So that's one thing, I guess. The other is, well, Kat can probably knows more because she grew up there. I mean, probably, she definitely knows more. But from the research that I did, I was especially interested whether the Grizzlies were trying to market themselves to the locals. And the problem was that they actually failed at marketing the team, because they started off on a good foot, I think, because when you think about like the jersey reveal, they were actually revealed in, I don't remember the name of the museum, was it the Museum of the Museum of Anthropology at the University of British Columbia, right? In 1994, they revealed their jerseys. So they started off really good because you have local ties, right? And also the colorway was great because they were paying homage to the indigenous peoples with the trim. I don't remember how the trim was called. It was called, I think, the West Coast trim, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah, it was kind of definitely a fashion style and thematic at the time.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, okay, that's great. So it was really great because it showed that the team, that the people who designed these jerseys actually did their research, right? And the name Grizzly sounds local as opposed to the Raptor in Toronto, which is, I mean, we all know it's from the Jurassic Park, right? There was this fad on like dinosaurs were super in like the early 1990s. So that's one thing. There's also the marketing, like the most creative marketing idea that I was able to find or that I was able to learn of was that Brian Reeves, Big Country, right? He had this particular hairstyle. I don't remember the name of the, how is it called? But people who would get the same hairstyle would actually be able to enter the game for free. There was this like organized that if you get cut by a barber and by the team barber or team designated barber, you can enter the get one game for free. So that was like the Senate, is it Nader? I don't know, was in, oh my God, I'm getting confused here with like my language, sorry.
Okay.
So it was like the top of marketing ideas, the best marketing idea, the most creative marketing idea that the team had. So that's not really good marketing, right? And as you said, the product wasn't really good. And that could be the turning point of the franchise because you can like find a common friend, but you can also find a common enemy, right? And the guy that I think of here is Steve Francis, and I'm guessing you know the story, right? And I'm guessing that some of our listeners...
For our audience, you can give us a little headline. Okay.
So in the 1999 NBA draft, the Grizzlies get the second pick, and they already have in the previous drafts they've picked a center. So in Brian Reeves, they picked Sharif Abdul-Rahim as a wing player. They got Mike Bibby, who wasn't particularly happy about the decision to be picked, and they picked Mike Bibby instead of Vince Carter, for example, or Dirk Nowitzki or Paul Pierce. They decided to pick Mike Bibby, who was a great player, by the way. I really like Mike Bibby. I even have a Mike Bibby Vancouver Grizzlies jersey. So, respect to
that's
the guy.
That's pretty random, but good for
that's
you.
That's pretty random. Yeah, that is like a really random jersey. Yeah, so they have a point guard in my VV, right? And then the 1999 draft comes along, and they have a chance with the second pick. That's the highest. Well, that's not the highest pick because they picked Mike Bibby second the year before. So, I mean, but they never got the first pick. I mean, there was like this rule that an expansion franchise could not get the number one pick. I don't know how long was the embargo, but it was a couple of seasons. And obviously, it really hurt the Grizzlies, who could really use the number one pick. Although what they could do with the number one pick is like a different issue. Anyway, so they have a chance to... So Elton Brand is like, well, more or less surefire number one, because he's from Duke. He is just like a... overall good guy. Personality wise, he's great. He's tall, he can play basketball, and he has a solid career. Now, when it comes to the second pick, there's a number of options. There's Baron Davis, there's Lamar Odom, who actually wants to play in Vancouver, who says all the right things, who actually comes to visit Vancouver. And he the journalists ask him which positions could he play, and he says that he could fit in with the guys. He is open to play either small forward or power forward. He can also play some point guard at this point. I mean, he was, whether that would be an option, I'm not really sure, but we will never know, unfortunately. And instead, the Grizzlies pick point guard Steve Francis, who is very transparent when it comes to expressing his opinion that he doesn't want to play for the Grizzlies. He even refuses to come to Vancouver and work out for them. So they have, and still they decide to pick Francis because they assume that, well, it was before the player empowerment era, right? And these things didn't really happen. Like, the most prominent example of when it happened was when the Clippers picked Danny Ferry, and he actually refused to come to the Clippers to report to training camp, and he played in like for a year in Italy, and then they traded him to the Cavaliers for Ron Harper, which was like such a bad trade for the Cavaliers and a great trade for the Clippers. Surprise, in like the 1990s Clippers, one of the good things that happened there. Anyway, so they pick Steve Francis and he refuses, and the journalists in Vancouver criticize Steve Francis. And he becomes like the common enemy because he's presented as entitled, as spoiled, even though he made it clear that he did not want to come there. He didn't want to play for Vancouver. He refused to work out for them. I mean, take a hint, right? And yet they pick him, and he could be this unifying force that we will show Steve Francis that we actually care about our franchise, that we care about our team, that we support our Grizzlies. We will not allow this American to, well, for the lack of a better phrase, spit in our faces, right? We will show that we care about our Grizzlies. And yet, they don't. So it's hard to understand why didn't the city rally behind its team, other than, well, the obvious thing is that the Grizzlies weren't really good. Yeah.
So McCaw was making rumblings of, either in private or because they sort of surfaced in the latter part of the decade. So in, I guess the way I sort of have seen it is I think around 1999 at some point, It either is announced or is discovered that McCaw is looking to sell some combination or some element of this team, whether it's the team itself or the ownership group that he controls. And it I guess it starts to spill out into the open. And I guess that doesn't sort of lend itself very well to a, I don't know, an endearing fifth or sixth season there with the fans.
Mm-hmm. So the sixth season was probably the worst in the sense that, the marketing basically stopped caring, right, about the team from what I remember. That they, like, people weren't getting season tickets on time, and when they did, they just came in like a blank envelope, with basically like no team logo or whatever. So it seemed that they just gave up, even though the new owner was saying all the right things, right? So I'm guessing that Kat had a lot, well, I'm not guessing, it's just that Kat had a lot to say about Mike Hainsley, right? The guy who bought the franchise from...
Yeah, let's talk about him. So, because Michael Hainsley is...
Mike, he wanted to be called Mike.
Who
because
knew?
Because he was Mike from Chicago. That's how he presented himself, like the man of the people.
This man of the people apparently got the franchise only after some shenanigans prior. It looks like McCaw was trying to, he had actually had a deal or had negotiated some kind of agreement with somebody local in Vancouver. But it turns out that that he was trying to, it was also Bill Laurie in St. Louis was sort of involved, right? So it's almost like people off of each other. So where does Mike Hainsley come into play? Because he's like the third guy in this mix.
Yeah, he came just surprisingly. So actually, I was going through like articles and as you said, the owner of the St. Louis Blues, right, wanted to buy the team. For whatever reason. And he just suddenly appears, I guess, at the last moment, and he comes out of nowhere. And David Stern is, the commissioner of the league at the time, is vouching for the guy immediately. And Mike Hainsley says that he will do everything to try to keep the team in Vancouver. And a year later, they relocated to Memphis. So it's really kind of shady and suspicious. And, maybe one day we will know, but unfortunately, the two people who were responsible for that deal and the two people who negotiated that deal with the ownership group in Vancouver are no longer with us, so we don't really know what happened and how, whether it was Stern who reached out to Hainsley or whether Hainsley, like in the last minute, appeared and just as this knight in the shining armor and actually his intentions were good. I don't really know. It was like super. That's one of the question marks that I still have when it comes to the whole story of relocation. Where does he appear and what were his motivations?
All right, what's this? Newspapers.com, fantastic. Hey, today's podcast is proudly brought to you by Newspapers.com, the ultimate playground for uncovering the grand slam moments of baseball's past. If you're a fan of the game, you're about to step into a time capsule of home runs and heroes. Newspapers.com lets you relive the glory days with nearly a billion pages of historical newspapers, capturing the crack of the bat, the roar of the crowd, and the unforgettable stories that define baseball history. Explore your favorite teams and players in papers nationwide, dating back to baseball's beginnings in the 1840s. For our baseball-loving listeners, newspapers.com has really knocked it out of the park with this special offer. Use the code GSA20 for an exclusive 20% discount on your subscription. That's promo code GSA20 on newspapers.com. It's your front row seat to the stories that made baseball the timeless sport we love. Thank you, newspapers.com, for your sponsorship of this week's episode. And now, back to our conversation. Well, look, I mean, it's pretty clear that in that period of time, you had McCaw, who had this agreement apparently underway with this local guy. I think his name is Dennis Washington. And then this other bid comes from Bill Lorre out of St. Louis. I think Lorre at the time had recently purchased the St. Louis Blues. So it sounds a little bit like the origination of the Vancouver story. Like, we got a hockey team. Let's have a basketball team as well. In a brand new arena called the Kiel Center at the time.
Yeah. And actually, if I may just interfere, yeah, because Lorre was, he really wanted an NBA team, right? Because he wanted to buy the Nuggets like a year earlier and the Charlotte Hornets a year later. So he actually wanted really, he wanted an NBA team badly, right? So that's kind of interesting.
Yeah, and
he did not care about what team it was going to be. He just wanted to have an NBA team.
Right, and in retrospect, I think St. Louis would have been a pretty decent market because it's in from a college perspective, and the St. Louis had the Hawks way back when, and so yeah, there's a viable basketball sort of vibe there in St. Louis, arguably still. But it's also interesting, too, because it the way it looks like it's playing out is because Washington was saying, I want to keep him in Vancouver, and Lorre was saying, I want to move him to St. Louis, whether through, you know, a straight face or behind the scenes, David Stern was at least publicly opposed to the idea of relocating. Because I guess the team, they hadn't met any movement of a team since the 80s. And, you know, this obviously started only 6 years ago or 5 years ago at the time in Vancouver. And, you know, that would sort of split stability and all that kind of stuff.
And you have some people like speaking in favor of the Grizzlies staying in Vancouver, like Jerry Buss of the Lakers is also very supportive of the Grizzlies staying in place. Right. So that's like a big vote of confidence.
Yeah, well, this also seems like, and this is probably for another whole nother podcast, but it also seems like this is David Stern, you know, and his interesting ways of running the league at that time, because we've seen it with the interesting mechanics or machinations in the St. Louis, in the Seattle to Oklahoma City drama.
Yeah.
But this is before then. And the idea, though, of it's interesting because what happens 4 days after Lorre settles with McCaw to kind of walk away from the deal, 4 days later on January 25th 2001, the Grizzlies are sold to Michael Heisley, and he apparently is stating that his preference is to keep this team in Vancouver. That sounds like it's following a narrative that Stern wants him to, but obviously it's not where it winds up. What do you think? Do you think this is Stern believing that this is going to stay in Vancouver, or
I mean,
or what?
To be honest, it's hard to say, but if I may, so I think that Mike Heisley was actually good at tricking people, and I'm only saying that. Well, not tricking, but maybe it's like a negative word, right? It has some connotation, so maybe bending people to his will, not in a negative or positive sense, just the way he was, because there was this former mayor of Vancouver, Art Phillips, and he organizes a We Love Our Grizzlies campaign, and he wants the Grizzlies to stay in Vancouver. And actually, after the trade is made, Art Phillips goes publicly with a statement that the people in Vancouver are forever indebted to David Stern and McCaw for their willingness to search for a good owner. And he also thinks that Hazy will save the team. So he is also very positive. And I'm guessing that he must have talked to Hazy before making that statement, right? And yet a year later, he calls Hazy a snake, and his taking over of the franchise, he calls it like a bloody plot. So I guess that maybe he was good at convincing people. And
he gets the team, and for whatever scenarios, right, if he claims it's pretty clear and very quickly, it seems, that the narrative builds very quickly that the Vancouver Grizzlies as a financial proposition is, and maybe probably have not previously disclosed, is worse off than maybe most people thought. And it's mm-hmm. it seems like it's a pretty quick transition to Heisley owns the team now, wants to keep it in Vancouver, at least says he does, but it's pretty obvious that the financial proposition of the Grizzlies staying there is not viable, and it just the drumbeat for that becomes excruciatingly loud.
Yeah, and it starts in like early January. So the season starts in like early November, I guess. It like varies, I guess, more or less. So in the season opener, the guy is performing the Canadian national anthem, and 3 months later, it's January, and he complains to the press how hard it is for him to keep the Grizzlies in Vancouver. And he openly discusses selling the team. And in February, they ask him whether the team staying in Vancouver is a viable option. And he says that he doesn't know. He can't answer that question honestly. And I think it's after the All-Star game or during the All-Star game that it is agreed upon that the Grizzlies are going to relocate. So 4 months after the season started, the Grizzlies are already on the move, and they are basically just playing for, I don't know, for what? What would be the motivation of, like,
I think I've read also, too, that Heisley, there had been accusations, I think maybe from Griffiths as well, or maybe only, or from that he kind of was sandbagging the team months into it, meaning he was not, you know, you mentioned some insufficient marketing and stuff, and and obviously the narrative building that it wasn't, but it seems like he was kind of sandbagging, if you will, to make that maybe more the reality than maybe perhaps it was when he picked up the team.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So that's also what happened, I guess, that he wasn't as invested emotionally as he probably should be. And yet to the press, he presented himself as the victim. Like, he complained that he can't attend the games of the team that he owns because people are going to boo him. And the thing is that he seemed genuinely happy that he was taking over the team. I mean, and it's just so, I don't know, if I were like a fan of the Grizzlies as Kat was, I would be like heartbroken that it happened so fast. And well, you couldn't do anything to stop the relocation. No matter what the fans would do, it was over. 4 months and the team was gone, right? More or less.
So give us a sense of the cities that were kind of in play, because it seems like there were a bunch of them sort mm-hmm. of circling around this, and maybe a little bit of a maybe you can kind of give us a thumbnail of each of the cities and their relative propositions and why they were sort of on the list and maybe why they ultimately lost out mm-hmm. to this city called Memphis.
So there were four teams that were in the process. So Louisville, Anaheim, New Orleans, and Memphis. And at one point, he even wanted to move the team to the suburbs of Chicago, but the inhabitants refused. Plus, I mean, the Chicago had the Bulls, the franchise of the 90s. So why would you want another team there? We already spoke, we already talked a bit about it when we talked about like the New York Knicks and Brooklyn Nets, right? So process of relocation. I mean, it was just strange.
I had also heard Buffalo, and I think even San Diego, or sorry, really? Las Vegas was even sort of thrown around, and I don't know. It seems like there was probably everybody's coming out of the woodwork.
Yeah, I mean, those were the teams that I heard had the biggest chance. So Louisville was very interesting because there would be like a arena that was worth $200 million. And the team would be sponsored by Kentucky Fried Chicken. And the proposed name for the arena was the KFC Bucket. And the team would be called the Kentucky Colonels. So yeah, like the Kentucky Colonels of the ABA.
I think that offer still stands. I mean, we've had plenty of conversations about Louisville, and I think they're very much strongly desirous of getting another NBA franchise back to kind of pick up the NBA.
Why not? Off.
Why not? Right.
Although probably Las Vegas and Seattle will be first in line. I don't know if there will be like a third team, but Las Vegas and Seattle will get like an NBA franchise in like I know 2-3 years tops, I guess. So Anaheim basically was not as interesting because another team in California from a marketing perspective that didn't quite work at the time. Plus the last team who relocated were the Sacramento Kings. They moved from Kansas City in 1985, so probably another team moving to California was not seen as something that was interesting for the NBA, who once wanted to be a league that was dominating the whole of America, right? The whole of the United States. And New Orleans got involved more or less the other team were the Charlotte Hornets, and New Orleans basically got the Hornets because of the problems with the owner, George Shinn. And, well, that's a totally different podcast, I guess, as well, if I may use the phrase that you used just a moment ago.
So how does Memphis wind up becoming the chosen one? My sense is that But a couple of those had stadiums, relatively new stadiums in place already, like I know in Anaheim, for example. But I guess Louisville and Memphis probably stood out more because while they didn't have facilities yet, they either were about to or could eventually. And maybe I'm getting the sense that becomes a bit more attractive because they can maybe bend or shape the development of said new arena more to their liking versus having to fill in a place that kind of already exists. I don't know.
Yeah. So basically the thing that worked in Memphis's favor was they had a big company that was based there. So FedEx, and FedEx was willing to promise that it would buy team and arena naming rights when the Grizzlies moved to Vancouver. So already there was some financial incentive there. Plus, the team could be more local. And there was actually, it was estimated that the local ownership group's stake in the team could reach up to 50%. Well, eventually it would reach 30, but it was still like a big percentage-wise. It was a big percentage for the locals to own their team. So in a sense, there was already the feeling that the Grizzlies would stay in Memphis. And Stern wanted a city which would keep its team. And that's probably, I guess, why Memphis was chosen, was because of the local ties. And it had some history with the ABA, although it wasn't like really good history. But most ABA teams folded anyway, so I mean, when you think about history.
Well, yeah, it's also a city that didn't have a top four professional team, and this is of the idea of being able to.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, they had the Tennessee Titans for a little while, but that was always moved. The goal was to move that team to ultimately to Nashville on the NFL front. But so I guess to sort of wrap up here, because and the rest, frankly, is all held in the book, which we're going to promote, of course, in a minute.
Yeah.
But okay. What of the transition? I mean, obviously, you know, there was a Save the Grizzlies thing in Vancouver and fans all that came about, and talked about that with Cat Jamie quite extensively. But when it's essentially sort of done, obviously, there's a temporary move to the pyramid while this new FedEx forum gets built, and obviously with the financial support of FedEx, as you're mentioning, is a big sort of charter sponsor. Mm-hmm. How does this team go over? I mean, they keep the Grizzlies name, which is curious, but the fans kind of took to them. But the financial benefit really didn't sort of there was no immediate change in the financial woes of this team when they moved, right?
Yeah, and the thing that sort of gets the team over, when you said that Hazley was sandbagging it, right? When it comes to the Vancouver Grizzlies, he wasn't doing the same in Memphis. He brings in Jerry West, which is a big deal. Like Jerry West becomes the general manager or the vice president of basketball operations. I'm guessing that he held both titles for some time. Anyway, so he makes these big trades. They draft Pau Gasol. They have this interesting roster. They have Jason Williams, one of the most exciting basketball players like ever, I guess, in NBA history. And yet they aren't as successful up until they embrace the identity of the city, I guess. So when you think about Memphis, as somebody who was born and lived in the United States, what comes to your mind, if I may ask you one question?
I've only driven through it once, and that was a stop with Graceland, right? But certainly blues music and barbecue, and there's, you know, also on the negative side, there's been, you know, quite a bit of racial tension over the many decades in Memphis. And that's literally kind of my initial assessment, but you know, and plus the fact that it's bereft of obviously University of Memphis, the former Memphis State, in terms of college basketball, pretty strong. That's kind of really all I kind of would say.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, so
not obvious though. Not obvious to me. Say versus even Louisville, where I've actually lived a period of time in terms of basketball, okay, Kentucky, and all that stuff. Right? Yeah.
And there's a big basketball culture there, right? So
yeah, huge.
I guess, yeah, huge. Okay, it's cool. So the thing about Memphis is, when you think about Grizzlies, the team that got over, if we may use like this, it's nice that you tied in the wrestling. I mean, getting over, is it like typically wrestling phrase? Is it like a typically wrestling phrase to use? Or because I only hear it when people talk about wrestling, that somebody like gets over or is over. Is it used like in other contexts as well?
I'm not sure what you're I'm not sure where you're coming from.
Okay. Because you said that when Grizzlies get over, how do they get over? Is it like
misspoken. No, I'm curious, as the name had not changed. They had not changed the name.
No. I wanted to say like the phrase that somebody gets over. I just was interested in, is it like a phrase that it's used in like regular English, or is it
Yeah, get over. I guess is I'm trying to remember what context I was using it in to get over.
About Grizzlies, how do they get over with the people in Memphis?
Oh yeah, I'm sorry.
The franchise.
That wasn't really what I guess that meant. I was really curious as to how received the team.
It was good how they get over, because I mean in wrestling it's used like somebody gets over, like a wrestler gets over, he becomes embraced by the fans. So that's how you use it. I think you use it properly. I'm sorry for the confusion here.
No, that's okay. I'm really curious as to sort of like, I mean, actually it was not a huge win for them in the immediate term, but how did it seem?
Yeah,
it seemed like the owner
understood the question.
Time.
I was just interested in the phrase. Yeah. So it's hard to pinpoint one particular moment, but it starts off with Zach Randolph, the basketball player, who is brought in and who has some issues in the past. And basically playing for the Grizzlies is like, well, I don't want to use big words here, but it's like his last chance at redemption. And he isn't a particularly flashy player, but he will give you like 20 points and 10 rebounds a game. And he will do all the little things that you need to do in order to succeed. He isn't afraid to stand up to people. As he has this famous phrase, I come from a place where bullies get bullied. So he's just a tough guy. And with him, the Grizzlies start to, as you said, get over with the Memphis crowd. And he is like the core player, a core element of what eventually becomes the core four. So he, Michael Conley, Marc Gasol, and Tony Allen. Correctly, I think it's Tony Allen, yeah. So they epitomize this grit and grind style, as they are called. So they aren't playing flashy basketball. Their games are based on defense. They're based on like 2-point shots and just slowly but surely progressing and moving forward. And the moment when the Grizzlies are able to, so the Grizzlies become like the source of identity for the city, and the city becomes the source of identity for the Grizzlies. And they are also reaching out to the people. Like, it turns out that this guy, Zach Randolph, who's just a tough guy off the court, he's a teddy bear in the sense that he is meeting with fans. He is gracious. He devotes his time to building bonds with the people who live in the city, with the supporters of the team. And other players are like that. They organize Christmas for the poor families. They just meet with people, not only in, because you have these like obligatory events, NBA cares. But the players are doing it on their own, not through like Make-A-Wish Foundation or any other foundation. They're doing it on their own because they want to. And they are embraced by the city because they like the city. They just not live here and play basketball here. They want to be ingrained in the culture of the city. And that's why I think the Grizzlies became so successful. Yeah. That's
well,
like a good explanation.
Yeah, and we could, you know, we could talk about sort of the players, the Pau Gasol years, all this kind of stuff, right? To me, the fascinating story is sort of the how and why of the origination of the team, its rough transition into its new home since 2001 in Memphis. And, you know, that said, right? At last, as we record this in the summer, early fall of 2023, No conference titles, two division titles recently in their last two seasons, which is indicative of something. No championships, of course. You know, occasional playoff appearances and whatnot, but you know, nothing that's truly that stands out per se. Obviously a great facility, but you know, a lot of facilities now are, you know, reaching the 20, 30 year old time frame. And that of course means that time for a new stadium, a new shakedown of a market for, you know, if not improvements, a brand new facility altogether. So they'll certainly be that. And it's also, you know, it's the reality that Memphis is still one of the smallest market cities in the NBA in the United States. So that, you know, that does have an effect on their overall valuation. Same with Oklahoma City, sore spot for Seattle, right? So to me, it's really interesting that, I don't mean to lump them together, but it's easy to do. Seattle, now Oklahoma City, Vancouver, now Memphis, right? And relocated to two of the smallest markets in the United States, you wonder if they had, for whatever miraculous reasons, had stayed in those two origination cities, I think their valuations would be higher because those two metropolitan areas are doing far more, are far more, shall we say, rich and full of citizenry versus the other two. Mm-hmm. But you know, that's it's hard to sort of look at the world that way. But that said, you know, Memphis has definitely created its own dynamic for the team. Grizzlies are obviously well established with Memphis. I think many people now, there's another generation at least, don't even know or remember that Vancouver was the origination point of this franchise. So I guess mission accomplished.
Yeah. I mean, when you think about, I mean, Los Angeles Lakers geographically don't make sense as well. And yet they work, right? So Memphis Grizzlies kind of work as well. Plus the fact that when the new owner, Robert Pira, I don't know how you pronounce it in English. I think it's Pira, right? Anyway, the new owner of the Grizzlies, when he bought the franchise in, I think it was 2012, he promised that the Grizzlies wouldn't relocate for the next 15 years. So, yeah, they still have time.
All right, our thanks and profuse apologies to Lukasz Miniowski for not only the conversation, but for tolerating my continued butchering of the name in my attempt to do it in the somewhat native Polish, but also the ridiculous delay in my losing the file and losing sort of track of when this book was actually to be published. It has been out since October of last year. It is called The Grizzlies Migrate to Memphis, From Vancouver Failure to Southern Success. It is published by the University of Tennessee Press. It is available now and has been for months wherever you find good books, of course, on our website at goodseatsstillavailable.com. Just search up this episode number 345, our just finished conversation about the Grizzlies going to Memphis, and you will find a convenient link to this book on Amazon. You will get it as fast as humanly possible. While you're on the website, please check out our merch page. You will see some great links to our friends at places like Royal Retros, of course, and oldschoolshirts.com with some promo codes and some goodness there, as well as our own a little set of merch. We'd like to get our Good Seats Still Available logo on a shirt or a cap or a button or a sticker or whatever. You can do that through our pals at TeePublic. You can also, while you're there, rummage through our curated collection of various defunct logo merchandise, also powered by TeePublic. Again, that's the merch tab on goodseatsstillavailable.com. While you're there, you can buy us a cup of coffee, proverbially, through our friends at Ko-Fi. There's a nice little button there. You can just send some change our way, and we appreciate that. Helps keeps our lights on and stuff. And what else? You can follow us wherever we go, or on various forms of social media. On the Twitter X thing, you'll find us at Good Seats Still. and on Instagram, we're at Good Seats Still Available, on Facebook, we're at Good Seats Still Available, on Threads, we are at Good Seats Still Available. You can send us some email if you'd like to. By all means, please do so. That address is hello@goodseatsstillavailable.com. Our thanks, of course, this week to our friend, our suburban Atlantan sports fan extraordinaire, Jerry Payne. Jerry Payne Audio Excellence, thank you for putting up with our hijinks this week. And thank you for listening. This is a wonderful time for franchise relocation. And we are working feverishly on some more follow-up for the Oakland to maybe Las Vegas, but certainly to Sacramento story. And, of course, the Coyotes moving from Arizona, as predicted, now to Utah, and maybe a backfill of a franchise in the years to come still in Phoenix. We're going to keep on top of that and try to get you a couple of quality guests for those. So stay tuned, and many, many more things to come in the weeks and months ahead. Thank you for listening. See you next week. Take care of yourselves.